Good afternoon and welcome to the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Charles Lindy, filling in for Celeste Quinn this Friday afternoon, and we have a guest in studio that's a regular segment we have here on the Afternoon Magazine, and this gentleman's been on a number of times. His name is Brian Silverman, an attorney from Champaign, and welcome to you this afternoon.
Nice being here.
I want to give just a brief introduction to our guest. He's in private practice for the last decade or so, or prior to that. He was a Champaign County public defender. He has been a candidate for the Illinois Legislature and the U of I Board of Trustees, unsuccessful, but he has announced that he's going to be a candidate for the Republican nomination for Champaign County Circuit Judge. And his experience covers criminal, family, real estate, you kind of name it, and he'll talk about it, I presume.
Three times is a charm, Chuck.
Oh, is that it? Third time's a charm.
Okay. I don't know. Will I get in trouble if I call you Farmer Chuck? Because you're not doing the farm stuff this afternoon.
No, you see, it was one of those things where they had to find somebody who'd be willing to interview you, Brian. They went through everybody, finally got down to me. So, you know, that's the way it works out.
Well, I'll call you Charles then.
That's fine. Charlie's fine, too.
All right.
Our phone numbers are 333-9455. That's 217-333-9455. If you're calling long distance, though, try the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. 9455.
Did you know that 9455 is also WILL?
By George, that's amazing. See what these lawyers know? I tell you, it's just amazing. I wanted to ask you something first off. Now, I'm not going to get into the whole race for the nomination for the Republican candidacy for circuit judge. I'll let Celeste deal with that on other programs.
Okay.
But in reading a little bit about it, and you've had 14 years, is it, on the Champaign-Urbana Cable Telecommunications Joint Commission?
Right.
And there's some question as to whether or not you would be, if you were to be the nominee and you were to be elected, whether or not you would be able to continue that position. Why is there what's the concern there? What's the restriction?
The Supreme Court has very definite rules about what judges can do. They changed it a few years ago, and as a matter of fact, there was a dissent within the Supreme Court changing the rule. Judges used to be allowed to teach and, in fact, make money teaching. They've changed that rule, and for some reason you can't teach before 5 o'clock, and you know they can teach in the evenings. And so during 9 to 5, I guess you have to be a judge. They have these specific rules. For example, I'm a precinct committeeman, and I have to resign that position because the Supreme Court says that judges and judicial candidates cannot hold office in any political party. And, of course, being a precinct committeeman is an office in a political party. Judges and judicial candidates aren't allowed, other than themselves, they aren't allowed to endorse candidates, which, of course, is what a precinct committeeman does, is endorse candidates. So there are all these specific rules about what you can do.
And you're restricted in what you can say as well about other candidates?
Well, I thought that was accurate, and they want you to be gentlemanly about it, I suppose, or gentlewomanly if you're a woman. But I've looked it over again, and you can't say anything that's inaccurate or patently false. You can, like in any other campaign, because you have a First Amendment free speech right, you can say what you like. You have to be a little careful, though, that you should only really propose your own candidacy and not say anything bad or negative about your opponents. But I suppose you can. Most judicial campaigns don't. And the Supreme Court tries to restrict these things. So when I get elected, there are certain outside activities I can and cannot do. Now, I believe being an appointed official to a board like the Cable Commission, I believe that would be acceptable because I don't get paid. They rarely meet during business hours. Occasionally we have a lunch meeting, but our meetings are usually 7:30 to 8:30, and they're usually in the morning, and then there are meetings at night. So it shouldn't conflict with my judicial duties. But it's something that I would have to check and get an opinion from the Supreme Court if they believe it's okay. Obviously, if there was any lawsuit or anything affecting the city, since I am an appointed official of the city of Champaign, appointed by the mayor, I suppose I would not be able to hear any cases involving lawsuits with the city. So
is that pretty much on the honor system that you would excuse yourself from those cases?
You really should. For example, let's say I'm hearing criminal cases and a former client of mine, or a divorce case, and a former client of mine comes in and is a litigant in front of me. If I remember it, the idea is to say, look, I'm going to recuse myself and not hear anything because I don't know that I could be very fair to both sides because obviously I know a lot about one of these parties, and that's not going to be fair to the other party. It might not even be fair to my former client. Let's say it is a criminal case, and he's told me some secret things during my prior representation that only I know about. I really shouldn't be hearing that kind of a case. There are some situations where you can tell the parties that you want to recuse yourself. For example, I own some stock in Busey Bank, and somebody comes in, and maybe it's a forged check case, and the victim was Busey Bank. I don't think I would be obliged to recuse myself in that situation, but I think I would be obliged to tell the parties, look, I own some stock in Busey Bank, and Busey Bank is a victim here, and if you want another judge, we'll certainly accommodate you and see that you get another judge. It's not, it is the honor system, but of course, if I don't remember that a person's a client of mine, and the person says, wait a minute, 15 years ago you represented my brother. If people tell me that, then of course I give them the option, well, if you want me to get off the case, I'll be more than happy to. You try, and in a small community, it's a lot more likely to happen than in a place like Chicago. You're a lot more likely to have those kinds of situations. I remember when Judge Jensen was sitting, you know, here's people who become judges, generally before they're judges, do all kinds of things. He was on the school board, and he did all kinds of volunteer activities and so forth, and you just have to try and watch any appearance of impropriety so that people aren't, so that it doesn't give the appearance to people that there's any edge or unfairness that one of the parties or litigants has. So I suppose it's on the honor system. I don't know how else you could work it.
Phone number is 217-333-9455, 217-333-WILL, to talk with Attorney Brian Silverman. The toll-free number, if you have questions, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. We can talk about, I guess, any topic that that comes to their mind. We'd be glad to give a stab at least. And I went through the papers recently and started looking for the recent stories that we could use maybe as a springboard for some of the conversation this afternoon. One of them that really caught my attention was this whole idea of videotaped confessions and whether or not the officers should be videotaping their interviews with the suspects as well as the confessions, or as one person even suggested, the videotape should be rolling for the time the officer steps out of the car and apprehends.
There's a lot of discussion. I'm on the Illinois State Bar Association Criminal Justice Section Council. That section council has judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys on it in about equal numbers. And we, at the request of the legislature, we review all pending legislation or proposed legislation in the criminal area. In fact, all of the Bar Association's various section councils do the same thing. So there's a family law committee, and they review proposed changes in family law. Of course, criminal law is where there's a lot of activity every General Assembly session, where lots of new laws are proposed. It's very politically popular. This is a law that's being proposed by the Attorney General, Jim Ryan, and there's a lot of discussion exactly how it works. Because another thing that you didn't mention that's, you know, should this be surreptitious, or is it something that you want to tell the person when you begin talking to them that this is going to be videotaped? There is a law in Illinois, an eavesdropping law, which would prohibit it to be done surreptitiously unless they change the law and make this an exception. There are some exceptions, of course, to eavesdropping if you get a court order or something like that. In federal jurisdiction, they just need the permission of the Attorney General's office, and they can surreptitiously tape conversations. But state law prohibits it, so it would not be admissible under present state law unless there were an exception. And, of course, a lot of defense attorneys are a little concerned. Well, you know, what are they going to tape? If he says something they don't like, you know, is that suddenly going to get erased? You're old enough, Charlie, to remember the 18-minute gap. Mm-hmm. Wasn't it an 18-minute gap?
18 minutes it was.
And, you know, it would have to be looked at carefully. Now, I would be in favor. I think videotaping is a two-sided coin. Because we have videotaping in this community in DUI cases. Many of the squad cars in Champaign, in the city of Champaign, have a videotape camera, and the officer wears a wireless mic and will tape the arrest. And, you know, when they're giving the person these field sobriety tests, you know, heel to toe and stand on one leg and all that kind of stuff, it'll be videotaped. And I've had my experiences, two of the cases, DUI cases that I've won, were because we get to show the jury this videotape. One, I took a bench trial, and the state's attorney puts the cop on who testifies about what happened and all this, and then we give the judge the videotape because it's a bench proceeding, and the judge takes it home and says, well, we'll resume the trial in a week. And we come back in a week later and finds the guy not guilty. And the judge confided in me later that, you know, if I didn't have the videotape, just based on the testimony of the officer, I would have found your client guilty.
What was it about the tape?
Well,
show?
Because the police officer said that his speech was slurred. And on the tape, his speech didn't appear to be slurred at all. The officer made a deal about him parking in the wrong direction on the street, so that it was, he parked on the left-hand curb,
right,
facing the wrong way. Well, on the videotape, it's clear that there was no place to park on the right-hand side. There was like a field or something. There was no place to pull over. And had he continued on to the next street and turned, you know, he might have been charged with fleeing and eluding. So, you know, he pulled over as quickly as he could and got out of traffic. None of that was mentioned by the police officer. By the way, the police officer didn't lie. I mean, he just kind of, you know, anything.
It was
that
his
was,
memory versus.
No, it was that these things would help the defendants, so they weren't mentioned. Mm-hmm. Of course, on the videotape, everything was there. And the officer said that he didn't do well on these various heel to toe and all this. And on the videotape, it looked like he was doing them just fine. There was a little thing with counting your fingers. You can't see this on the radio, but it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Wait a minute, I lost one. Well, it's because you're supposed to count your thumb twice, and most people forget to do that. They do one. I'm counting the thumb, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you go back, 6, you know, people. So
right.
It's 9. So the officer made a big deal that he didn't count his fingers correctly. And he was supposed to count backwards from 66 to 48, and he missed 49 or something, and or skipped over a number. And, you know, the judge commented that, people who are sober are likely to. Another thing that the police do when you're stopped is they'll say to you, recite the alphabet from G to S. And everybody, even sober people, say, let me see, A, B, C, D, E, F, oh, G,
right.
H, I, you know, because you can't just start at G, and then, but you're marked down for that.
Now, I'm getting the impression from what you're saying, though, that the police are inherently trained to give you the worst case, worst look that you possibly could.
I mean, they have an interest. They have an interest. I mean, they arrested you. They certainly have an interest in showing the judge or the jury that they were correct in arresting you. I mean, they certainly don't want to say, well, gee, now that I think about it, I was wrong in arresting him. So, of course, they're going to give what their impression was. They're trained to arrest people who they believe commit a crime. On the other hand, the other side of the coin is, I've seen videotapes where the guy is falling down, slobbering, and vomiting and urinating on himself and just looks awful. And I show the tape to my client. I say, I really think we ought to plead guilty here. If we show this to the jury, you know, the jury's going to be, they won't even go to the jury room to convict you. They'll just do it right there.
Mm-hmm.
And so it helps both sides. And I think it's a good tool. But what I would be in favor of and what I'm going to push for with the Bar Association is that we make a recommendation, unlike many laws, make a recommendation that we try this, but have a sunset provision. For example, I'm saying, well, let's try it for 2 years and see how it works. And after 2 years, we'll have some experience with how it works. We could then tweak it a little bit and maybe make some changes or make some corrections to make it a better tool. Obviously, Jim Ryan is the Attorney General. He wants it to help them get more convictions. And that's okay. I'm a citizen, and I think we ought to get, you know, we ought to be convicting guilty people. But I think it's a good tool because the best example I could think of is, do you remember the movie My Cousin Vinny?
Mm-hmm.
It was a great movie, and these two boys are accused of shooting a store clerk. And when they're being questioned by the sheriff, by the way, the sheriff in that movie was the guy who was in Animal House. He was the guy in the motorcycle in Animal House.
Oh, yeah.
He grew up to
D-Day.
Be the sheriff, D-Day.
Right.
He was the sheriff. So when he's questioning this one young man, he says, well, let's see. So you went into this convenience store and you shot the clerk. And the kid says, I shot the clerk. I shot the clerk. And he said it like that. And, of course, when they go into court for the preliminary hearing, the sheriff says, and then I asked him if he shot the clerk, and he remarked, I shot the clerk. I shot the clerk. And, of course, that would, you know, if something like that were videotaped, you could tell the difference in the tone and the body language rather than just reading something. And you know, I mean, you work with words all the time. It's what you do for a living. Your voice inflection, the way you say things, totally changes the meaning of what you're saying. I mean, the words on a piece of paper could mean several different things,
right,
depending on the way in which they're said. So I think videotaping, and we don't call them confessions anymore. We actually call them statements because not all statements are confessions. All confessions are statements, but not all statements are confessions. I think it's a good idea.
Our phone number is 217-333-9455, 800-222-9455. Our guest is Brian Silverman, an attorney here in Champaign. We can get on to other topics as you wish, so otherwise we'll stick to the topics that I'm interested in.
Why isn't anybody calling,
Charlie? I don't know, just because you're so fascinating. They're just enthralled by what you're saying, I think is what it is. 800-222-9455. Now I got to go the next step here.
Okay,
go ahead. From all you've said, especially the last part, about how the voice inflection and the body language,
right,
means so much in interpreting what actually was going on.
Right.
Why can't we go into a courtroom with our cameras and our microphones?
Because it's for the jury to see. The trier of fact, the whole idea of being able to constitutionally confront witnesses and cross-examine them is so that the trier of fact, which is either a judge or a jury, the trier of fact can determine the credibility of witnesses from looking at their body language and listening to the inflection in their voice.
But it would do away with so many complaints lawyers have about the people in the media and how badly they report,
right,
things.
Right.
If we could come out there and say, well, this is actually what you said,
right,
not just what I heard you say.
Right. Just it worked real well in the OJ case, didn't it?
Wonderfully.
And I'll give you another example where it worked. There was some police officers in Miami who were accused in a very racially charged atmosphere of shooting some young men in Miami. The case was moved to Tampa because of the publicity and because of the volatile nature of it. And they videotaped it, and the news in Miami, of course, the editors of the news would take snippets. I mean, here's a trial that lasted 6 hours, and they would put 20 seconds or 30 seconds worth of it on the air. By the end of the trial, the viewing public in Miami was convinced that these police officers were all guilty. Well, the jury, who heard all of the testimony, not just 30-second snips on the news, the jury who heard everything acquitted these guys. And right after the verdict of acquittal, there was a riot in Liberty City, a section of Miami, because the way in which the videotape of the trial had been edited,
mm-hmm,
because the people editing it had a bias and they thought these guys should be convicted, so they edited it in such a way that it made them look like they were guilty. I have no problem with a little camera. We have little tiny cameras nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
Put it in the back of the courtroom, turn it on at 9 o'clock in the morning and turn it off at 5. Put it on a cable channel and anybody could tune in anytime they want. What I'm afraid of is the way in which it's edited. And the editor gets to choose what they think is important, and that's not necessarily what the jury thinks is important. So if it's just on all the time, and it's, you know, it shows the witness box, and that's about all, I think it's a good idea. It's the editing of it that I don't like and that I'm opposed
to. I don't know how court TV is doing, but I can say when I covered trials some years ago, I found it fascinating to sit through a trial.
Sure
it is. It's some of the best entertainment around.
Sure it is.
We have a caller now, and they are on line one. Good afternoon to you.
Hi. Are you discussing just certain topics, or are you wide open today?
We're wide open. Go right for it.
My question is, who decided that you can't buy beer before 12 o'clock on Sunday? I can't imagine that the majority of people don't find that an inconvenience somehow, and yet this never gets changed.
His name was Bob, wasn't it? Not the guy who decided that, no.
Where is it that you can't buy beer before noon on Sunday?
Champaign County.
Around here.
In the county or just in the city of Champaign?
No, Champaign County.
Well, then it was decided by the county board. You know, when I was a student here many moons ago, they had things called blue laws. You couldn't buy liquor at all on Sunday, which meant that if you were in a bar at midnight, you better stock up and buy your drinks at 5 to 12 because after midnight they couldn't serve liquor. In fact, years ago, Champaign County, the only place you could get a drink on Sunday was in Ivesdale. And my former secretary grew up in Ivesdale. She said when she was a kid, all these great big cars from Champaign and Urbana would drive out to Ivesdale, and there were a half a dozen taverns in Ivesdale that were full of people from Champaign and Urbana drinking on Sundays.
And driving back home.
And driving back home. Those laws are passed by the localities, the local, either the county or the city.
Okay, well,
just as the city of Champaign says, you have to close at 1. In fact, something was on the news last night that Charleston is experimenting with opening bars till 2 a.m. to avoid college kids going back to their apartments or fraternities and continuing to drink in an unsupervised way. So those are local rules, and I suppose you could go to the county board and tell them, gee, you know, I really need a beer at 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Well, no, here's the point, Brian. The point is that I think that a majority of people, I mean, you go down to Schnucks to do your shopping on Sunday morning,
right.
You want to buy a 12-pack of beer, but you can't because some people who apparently are holier than thou think that, you know, you're sacrificing the Sabbath here by doing your demon drinking.
I think you're attributing something to them that may not, I don't know, but it's certainly if a majority of the people, well, I celebrate the Sabbath on Saturday.
Exactly,
so.
But I'm saying isn't it indicative, Christian-dominated society?
The caller, you're exactly right. That's what it goes back to, is that the people who make these laws believe that on Sunday morning you ought to be in church and you ought not be out buying liquor. You make a good point that if you're at Schnucks at 10 o'clock and you want to buy something for your afternoon barbecue, you're going to have people over to watch the football game.
But don't you think the majority of people are like that? And if that is true,
sure.
Why doesn't this ever get changed?
Because the majority of people don't go to their elected representatives and tell their elected representatives to change it. But I would suspect if the elected representatives, in this case the county board, if you went to the county board or the city council of either city and had a large number of people and said, we think this ought to be changed, I think you're likely to get it changed. If you live in Champaign, I would suggest call a couple of city council members, Tom Bruno, Jim Green, call the mayor, Jerry Schweihart, and say, I'd like to have this issue visited. Jerry Schweihart's the liquor commissioner, and he could approve it. And I'm sure that they could put it on the agenda of a city council meeting and have public hearings. And if enough people come out supporting it, I'm sure the city council would change it.
Okay.
So it's not something that one person just arbitrarily decided. It's a holdover from, you're right, it's a holdover from years ago when people thought you ought to be in church on Sunday morning. And maybe it's time that those kinds of things, shopping habits have changed, and maybe it's time that we retire those laws.
Okay, thanks for your time.
Thanks for your call. Our phone number is 217-333-9455, 800-222-9455. Again, 800-222-9455, outside of the immediate area. If you're in Champaign or Urbana, give us a call at 333-9455.
You know, the last caller made a real good point. There are a lot of people who are concerned about laws that they consider to be arbitrary or old-fashioned. When I ran for the legislature, as you so kindly pointed out, unsuccessfully, one of the things I said was...
It wasn't my fault.
I know. One of the things I said was, you know, maybe we ought to not pass any laws for a couple of years. When I got out of law school in 1971, the entire Illinois Revised Statutes took up 3 volumes. Now it's up to 9 volumes. The criminal code was 68 pages long. Now it's 956. 6 pages long. Maybe, I mean, we got along fine with the laws back then. What do we need all these new laws for?
Now, I've had a solution for that for a long time. And it goes back to when I was covering the state legislature, and George Ryan was a representative. We were talking one time, and he is a pharmacist, if I remember correctly.
He still is,
I think. And we were talking about how he and another pharmacist on the floor would refuse to vote on measures that had to do with pharmacy because mm-hmm. there would be a conflict of interest. And mm-hmm. if we could just get all the lawyers to refuse to vote on anything that had to do with the law, we would be fine.
You might be surprised, though, to find out that in the state legislature, in the House of Representatives in Springfield, less than about 22% are lawyers. And in the Senate, it's about 27 or 28%.
That'd be enough to block things up, though.
Way lower than a majority.
But now, it would still be enough to block them up.
In Congress, there are a bunch of lawyers. I mean, the president's a mm-hmm. lawyer. But, you know, somebody just said the other day, they were talking about this, Clinton is vetoing the tax cut bill that the Republicans are proposing. Did you know that if Congress did nothing for 10 years, just did nothing, and just passed, you know, something that the previous year's budgets would continue on and on and on, that after 10 years, the deficit would be erased completely? So all Congress has to do is stay home for the next 10 years, and our trillion-dollar debt would be gone. Maybe it is a good idea that legislators, both federally and state and local, maybe, you know, they ought to go through and they ought to go through the statutes and clean out some of these archaic laws. That there was a law I remember when I got out of law school. If you're driving a car, you have to get out at each intersection and ring a bell or blow a whistle so that you wouldn't frighten the horses. And it was still on the books in 1971. You know, those kinds of things. And maybe these laws about selling liquor, they really ought to be reviewed, and the ones that are archaic ought to be changed or thrown out.
We have a caller on line 4 from Crete, and good afternoon to you.
Hello. I have a quandary for the good barrister. I think my mother, I know my mother has reached the age of senility. She doesn't remember things, and she forgets a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to get information about her, but her doctor that she goes to refuses to give us any information about her physical condition. And it seems like we're sort of reached a dead end here with this kind of ability to get information, since she is, I think, senile by this time.
There's a solution to your problem.
A solution, good.
The solution is, unfortunately, you're going to have to hire a lawyer, I imagine.
I'm going to get a lawyer?
Yeah, because you can go to court, and if you have sufficient evidence, and, of course, these things can be subpoenaed, and the doctor can't refuse to honor a subpoena, and if you can convince a judge that this person is not able to take care of themselves, then the court can appoint you, or if you have brothers and sisters, you can be appointed as the guardian for this person. And then once you're the guardian, you can make decisions. You can make medical decisions. You can make financial decisions. You can make all sorts of things. It would be as though you were this person's parent and you were making decisions for them. And it's not that difficult, but as you understand, it's not intended to be simple. I mean, they don't want people going in like, say, you know, I don't like, you know, my mother's been buying herself a new car every year, and I want her to die, and I want that money. You know, I don't want her wasting her money on cars. That's not the idea. The idea is if, as what you described, this person is senile and has a medical condition where they really are unable to care for themselves or unable to make knowing decisions, then either the children or some other responsible person could be named as the guardian. And, of course, then the doctor has an obligation to give the guardian the information, just as if your minor child went to a physician, you have a right to find out what's going on with your minor child.
Two questions. Well, what kind of judge, there's so many judges out there, what kind of judge would we go to on that occasion?
I think that aren't you in Cook County or are you in Will County?
Oh, we're in Will.
Will County is probably large enough that they have a probate, but any circuit judge is capable of hearing these kind of cases, and this would be in the area of probate, and What they do is they simply assign judges to hear certain kinds of cases, and I'm sure there's one or two judges in Will County that are assigned to hear these kinds of cases.
She lives in Cook County, my mother.
Well, then you would probably want to do it in Cook County, and that would probably be, depending on where she lives, probably downtown in the Civic Center, and probably in the probate division is where the judges who hear these kinds of cases would be sitting.
The problem is, sir, is the lawyer that she, the doctor she has now doesn't believe, as far as we can tell, that she has this problem of senility.
Doesn't matter. What do you care what he believes? You get another doctor to examine her.
So the judge would hire a second doctor to examine my mother.
The judge could enter an order allowing somebody else to examine her, sure. And not only physically, but mentally, too, so that the judge could get a real overview of what her problems are.
I see. So he probably...
And you don't have to depend on the doctor she's going to. You know, you say, wait a minute, judge, we think that this doctor is wrong. The judge will say, okay, you know, go to another doctor. Or the judge will pick a doctor.
Of course, we could get my mother to sign a waiver, and by that... Of course, if she signed the waiver, if she was demented, the waiver had no significance then.
Well, but then the doctor is saying two different things. Either she is or she isn't. And if she's capable, then she could sign a waiver, and that's common. Just sign a waiver allowing you to get all the information.
I see.
And then the doctor, once there's a valid waiver, then the doctor has to give you the information.
And the judge might, if we ask him to have both a medical doctor and a psychiatrist check her out. Is that true?
Sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, thank you very much for your information.
Thank you for your call. We have.
And it's intended to be a little complicated. It shouldn't be an easy thing to do, because you know, as I say, you know, if children are just unhappy with the way their mom is spending her money, it shouldn't be an easy thing to do, but. In the
sometimes
case the caller
necessary.
Talked about, yeah, it sounds like it's necessary.
We have other callers on the line. Champaign County on line one, and good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Brian, you stated that you were on the criminal board for the state, and I was just kind of curious. One of the things that I've found out in the past, it seems like when there's an accident involved, the officer feels compelled to give a ticket, even though...
Right.
There was an act of God, and an incident that I'm talking about is where, like, a front tire blows, and
right.
You cross the center line, get in an accident,
right.
And they give you a ticket for improper lane usage.
Right.
Is this something that the insurance companies are really wanting, or is this...
No. First of all, let me correct. I'm on the... criminal justice section, which is like a committee of the State Bar Association, and we meet regularly and we discuss criminal justice issues that we think are of interest to lawyers around the state. But your point is well taken. Each jurisdiction has their own policy. Champaign and Urbana have a policy that every time there's an accident, they write a ticket. The police officer investigates, talks to both people in the accident, tries to determine who was at fault, and writes a ticket. Many jurisdictions, Chicago, for example, the officer might not write a ticket. Excuse me. There's no law that says you have to call the police when there's an accident. You have to report it. There are reporting requirements, and you have to go to the nearest police station and report it. But there's no rule that says the police have to give a ticket. Excuse me. They do, by policy, write tickets. Frequently, when you go to court, those tickets get thrown out because the state's attorney who prosecutes them looks at it and says, well, you know, we think that this person is right. You know, the tire blew out and, you know, this was truly an accident. They didn't purposely cross the lane or cause this accident. Although, I don't want to get into the technicalities of it. You get it. You would get a turn to... The insurance companies know, and people are commonly mistaken in saying, well, I know that I wasn't at fault in the accident because the other guy got a ticket. Well, that may or may not mean anything. And in a civil trial, when you sue somebody for damages as a result of an accident, who got a ticket is not even admissible unless the person pled guilty. And if they pled guilty, the plea of guilty is only admissible to show an admission on their part that they did something. But the rules for civil cases are completely different than for criminal cases. And even though a person got a ticket, a jury might decide that they weren't at fault. And so the insurance companies, they kind of use the ticket as a, you know, something to hang their hat on. But it's not of that great importance to the insurance company.
We have a number of callers waiting to talk to you. Let's try and get to as many of them as we can. Line two from Joliet. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon.
Yes.
I just have a question about wills.
Mm-hmm. From Will County, right?
Yeah, that's true. The land of wills. When I inherited some money and property when my mother passed away, and I mean, everything was seemed to be fine. It was divvied up amongst all the, you know, her surviving children.
Mm-hmm.
But do we end up with a listing of everything that was spent out of her estate?
Sure. The executor, that's not an area of law that I'm real familiar with, but I'm familiar enough that the executor, if it's a will situation and it's probated, before the estate could be closed, the executor has to give an accounting of where everything went, and the judge then can determine that everything was done according to the will. And of course the executor might have to hire people and pay them out of the estate, and the judge would determine whether those payments are appropriate or if they're too high or something. So yes, there needs to be an accounting before the estate could be closed.
Now, when would that happen? When should I have received this?
Gee.
Is there a time limit?
Yes, there are time limits, and I'm, you know, Charlie, you're going to hear me say something you don't hear very often. I don't know. But there are time limits as to when these things need to be done. If it's a particularly complicated estate, the executor could go to the court and get extensions on these time limits, but there are definite time limits as to when these things have to be filed with the court.
Well, here's my question. This was the problem.
You need to call whoever the attorney was that's doing the probate of the will.
The problem arose in this way. The money was divvied up, and checks were sent out, and
mm-hmm.
my brother was the executor, and his friend was the attorney. I said, how much did you pay the attorney? He said, none of your business.
Oh, well, it is your business.
And that's what I thought.
If you're a beneficiary, and you are a beneficiary, you're entitled to know that kind of stuff. Now, you know, it's fair for him to pay a reasonable fee, but let's say the attorney spent 3 hours on the case and he's going to give him $3,000. You know, you might want to go to the judge and say, wait a minute, judge, since I'm getting a third of all the money, I think a reasonable fee for this attorney might have been $1,000, which means the other $2,000 should be divvied up. I'm entitled to an extra $700 because I think he really overpaid the lawyer. So in that kind of situation, of course, you're entitled to know.
Okay, I want to thank you for your call. We've got a caller on line 3 from Salem.
Not that lawyers would ever overcharge, you know.
Never, right.
Hello. Well, I do agree with you. It's important to see the demeanor of the witness.
Sure.
But with the videotaping, it seems to me like then if it's just parts of it replayed or videotapes can be altered,
right.
You know, and then it's a person's right to be able to get out the truth, the whole truth, and
right.
nothing but the truth, right.
right?
And then just some other principles like searches are supposed to be warranted, and right, we're still on to the basic rights, and on the testimony of two, so it isn't just one person saying something about someone. Is that still a basic principle?
No. I don't know that it ever was. What you're talking about is if something needs to be corroborated. And in some cases, there need to, before something would be admissible, it needs to be corroborated. There's a theory in the law that a confession, without any corroborating evidence to corroborate the confession, that the confession is of no value. If I go in a police station and admit that I killed somebody, excuse me, must be something in the air. If I go in the police station and say I killed somebody, but they don't find a body and they don't find any evidence of anybody being murdered, the confession is kind of meaningless. But you make some very good points, and those are exactly the kinds of things that we fear about videotaping. Anybody who saw the most recent Star Wars movie, you know, what's the what's there's a creature. He's one of the stars of the movie, the guy with the long
George
ears.
Jar Jar Binks.
Yeah, that's totally computer generated. It doesn't exist. Such a creature doesn't exist on the face of the earth, other than in somebody's computer.
Well, and beyond that, he took the smile off the kid in one scene and put it on the other scene.
Yeah, it was all edited on a computer. So marvelous things can be done with videotapes.
Yeah.
And one of the things, you know, those are some of the things we're worried about. Can these tapes be edited or changed or altered? And yes. If we tape these things, you would want to see it from the beginning to the end without any gaps or things like that. But those are legitimate concerns.
We have just about 4 minutes left in the program this afternoon. Try and get our last two callers in here on line four, rural Oakland. How are you today?
Good afternoon. Referring again to the Sunday liquor law, why isn't that blatantly in violation of the U.S. Constitution? It obviously favors one religious establishment over another.
Well, because it's within the police powers of these states, and the 10th Amendment, which everybody forgets about, says that any rights not guaranteed to the federal government by
reserved
this Constitution are reserved to the states.
Right.
And the U.S. Supreme Court just says this is something for the states to deal with. And the states have said that the local municipalities have inherent police powers to regulate things like liquor sales. And if the local people want to regulate liquor sales on Sunday morning, it's not an establishment of a religion, I suppose. Because they're going to say that's not the reason they did it. So
well, it's also in violation of the state constitution of Illinois. And if they can use police powers to violate other guarantees of freedom, why can't they go ahead and do that?
They sometimes try.
Let me
suggest this. Suppose I go out and I say, I'm a night person. I don't like the daytime. I'm a night person. And I object to the fact you're discriminating against me because my religion says, my religion is Vampira. And I'm only out at night, and I want to drink in a bar at 2 o'clock in the morning, but gee whiz, you got these laws that all the bars have to close at 1. You know, you can carry that. The answer to your question is I believe it's been litigated, and I believe they said that this is a legitimate use of police powers of the localities, and they could make reasonable laws regulating liquor. And, you know, their attitude is, you know, you have plenty of time to drink. You don't have to have 24 hours a day. And there are some localities, unincorporated areas, perhaps in some counties, where you can drink all hours. So
it begs the question, though, as to whether or not there is a secret society of bloodsuckers among lawyers.
We know the answer to that.
Let's go to line number one from Urbana. Good afternoon.
Oh, good afternoon. About 2 seconds left. I just wanted to mention that I've just finished reading a book called A Civil Action, and it left me feeling very distressed about the law. Is there reason for me to feel that way, or is that journalistic extrapolation?
The latter. The law is in pretty good shape. It's not perfect. It's got a lot of, you know, there are a lot of things that need to be changed and made better. And we can always tweak it and make it better. But generally speaking, I think the law is in pretty good shape. And I really don't think you have too much to fear. And I think journalists kind of take liberty with those kinds of things to make it an exciting book.
Is that so?
So be confident.
Giant corporations, and it seemed to me as if they barely got a tweak.
Well, they're the favorite whipping boy. Giant corporations are always avaricious, greedy, and malevolent. But I don't think that's so true in real life. I really don't.
Okay.
and journalists are always overstating things. Wouldn't it be fair to say, though, that the law is only as good as those who enforce and practice it?
Sure.
Just as the media is only as good as those who are doing it?
We like to say that we're a country of laws and not a country of people. In terms of the law is supposed to be the same for everybody, including large avaricious corporations and journalists and lawyers. And we hope that we have a system that makes the best effort to be fair to everybody. I think we really do.
Any final comment today?
Yeah, we ought to have more time.
Well, I think so, too.
I really,
we don't.
I really enjoyed being here. Charlie is one of my favorite journalists, and we've known each other for a long time. When you say you covered the courthouse, I was there.
That's right.
It's been my pleasure being on your show.
And mine too, having you here. Thanks very much. Brian Silverman, attorney from Champaign, and The Law on You will be back. It's a regular feature here on The Afternoon Magazine.